Hi, I'm Cyndi Lauper. My scalp was covered with psoriasis. Felt like I was trapped between a rock and a hard place. Then I started Cosentyx.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe plaque psoriasis 300 milligram dose. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for TB. Serious allergic reactions, severe skin reactions that look like eczema, and an increased risk of infections, some fatal, have occurred. Cosentyx may lower ability to fight infections, so tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if IBD symptoms develop or worsen. Learn more at Cosentyx.com or 1-844-COSENTYX.
Cosentyx works for me.
Ask your doctor about Cosentyx.
Looking for a new show to dive into? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like the full season of FX's epic limited series Shogun, FX's new international spy thriller The Veil, starring Emmy and Golden Globe winner Elizabeth Moss. And don't miss the all-new crime series Under the Bridge, inspired by shocking true events and starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. Here, hosts John Golia and Greg Fife, two of the world's most respected aviation experts, talk about all things aviation safety. This podcast is brought to you by PAMA, the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance. Get a customized quote at avemco.com or give them a call at 888-241-7891. Now it's time to buckle up, because it's wheels up on the latest episode of Flight Safety Detectives.
Well, hello, my friend. It's another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. We are toddless today. It's just you and me. I've been traveling, as I typically do, and I know that you are out and about. So what's going on, and where are you?
I'm back in Boston. I was in upstate New York yesterday, or day before yesterday, and it was just a day trip. And I'm back now through Thanksgiving.
Okay.
In fact, right after Thanksgiving, you and I have a joint trip coming up.
Yes, we do. Yep. So I know I just got back. I had two trials and a deposition in a 12-day period. So that was quite a bit of brain damage. But, you know, it's all in the interest of aviation safety.
They didn't lock you up?
They tried. I was able to escape. I went in stealth and got out of there stealth. So, well, I know it's been a busy month so far, and we're 2.5 weeks into the month, John. There's been a number of fatal accidents, you know, and it's a variety of airplanes, from an RV-6 through a King Air, a Twin Comanche, a Mooney. And of course, a 172 that we're going to talk about today, involving a guy who just recently went to space on one of Bezos's Blue Origin spacecraft. But, you know, again, our sponsors, especially Avemco Insurance, is, you know, it's got to be crazy for the insurance industry when we have this kind of run of accidents. We have to presume that these airplanes are insured. And the insurance companies have just got to be beside themselves, because the losses are mounting. And in this particular month so far, they're mounting at a pretty good rate.
Well, you know, years ago, I can remember we had 30 years ago, well, a little less, 25 years ago, we were having about 1,800 accidents a year. And a lot of them were very frustrating, like 400 or so that ran out of gas.
Yeah.
That used to drive me nuts, because how stupid can you be as a pilot to run out of gas? I'm sure there was a few of those that got caught in weather and they couldn't get into their alternate and, you know, some extenuating circumstances, but not all of them. I mean, it was trying to get back home because the gas in my home airport's 5 cents a gallon cheaper
Yeah.
You know, that's, but yeah, I've been watching those accidents as well. And there's no rhyme or reason to them so far. I mean, is it an example of what we've been preaching for months now about steel pilots coming out and think they're going to walk out to the airport and pick up where they left off after not flying for an extended period, not thinking about flying, not doing pre-flights, not getting really close to your airplane so that you understand all that's been going on to it, because airplanes don't like to be sitting around either.
Yeah.
A lot of them must be entering into this.
You know, it's crazy, John. I mean, I'm a FAA FAST team representative, so we had an annual training today. And, you know, we're still talking about the same subjects. I brought up the fact that we've had a number of flight instruction accidents, which really concerns me. Training accidents with flight instructors. There shouldn't be accidents with flight instructors on board, because if a student does make a mistake, where is the flight instructor to take the appropriate corrective action? You know, and something's being lost there, and I'm not sure what it is. That's why I've been tracking all these accidents, trying to find a common denominator. But the other thing we are talking about, of course, is loss of control. And that is the basis for the accident we're talking about today. Not only is it a loss of control type accident, but of course, it had a flight instructor on board. So again, these are the issues that it's repetitive. And while we try to make sense of these accidents and understand the nuances so that we can at least enhance aviation safety, where is this message getting lost?
Yeah, it's really lost too. I mean, part of me wants to say, we in the aviation industry trying to reach our pilots and others, we're doing the same old things over and over again. They're not working. We've got to come up with a new mixture, a new formula to deliver the safety message to everybody and make sure that it's received. You know, that in human factors, we used to call it spray and pray after an accident. So you come running out, you train everybody. So you spray all this training out there and you pray some of it sticks.
Yeah.
We need to do more than that. We need to make sure that people are understanding it. Because I'm sure that, you know, in this month, maybe there was 8 or 10 accidents. I'm sure that most of those could have been prevented.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's, I think, obvious, John, as obvious as it is to you and me. But the question is, why isn't it sticking? And what more can we do? You know, there's a number of podcasts out there that pilots like you and me are trying to, you know, preach that message. I know a number of the guys that are doing these podcasts, you know, Max Trescott and all these guys, we're pumping out what we think is very good information, their tools, their learning lessons, their, you know, reiterations of policies and procedures and operational discipline and all of these things. But why is this message getting lost? Is it because, you know, oh, it can't happen to me. I would never do that. I would never put myself in that position. One of the other things, of course, that I'm seeing of late are drugs, more drugs in pilot systems when we're getting the tox back. Now, a number of pilots, and you and I are going to have a discussion about this in the near future, because there's just been so many accidents of late where some level of drug, even over-the-counter medications, have been found in the pilot, and the board has zeroed in on that. Some of it is rightly attributed to the pilot and their performance. Some of the board has tagged pilots with being in somewhat of an incapacitated state because of these, quote, drugs, yet they have no level that they can turn to say that it was or it was not an effect on the pilot's performance. I have a real issue with that because I'm dealing with one of those accidents right now where just because it was found in the system doesn't mean that the pilot was under the influence of this particular antihistamine. And for the board to make that leap of faith, like, well, because it was there, it had to be impairing the pilot's judgment or performance, is just totally flat wrong, because as anybody knows, these drugs all have a half-life and a quarter life. I mean, marijuana, if you look at somebody, and you and I have been in these accidents where somebody has smoked marijuana a week before, had nothing to do with marijuana for a week, but it's still found in traces in a body or toxicology study. Again, you can't say that pilot was under the influence. So we're going to be talking about that more in depth. But this accident that you and I are going to be talking about today in brevity, because we don't have a lot of information, but it became a noteworthy accident because of one of the pilots on board this Cessna 172.
Sure did. I mean, he just went to space with Shatner and all the pomp and circumstances that went with it. I mean, it's really unfortunate. This guy was only a private pilot's license, according to what the FAA has said. But it's not clear how much time he had, because I don't trust the numbers that I get from the FAA sometimes. They're usually behind the times.
And it looked like he may have been a newly minted instrument pilot, because the issuance date on his certificate, based on the FAA record, was of recent. It was like May of this year. Whether that was a reissuance because of an address change or something else, or he got an instrument rating at that point, that's yet to be ferreted out by us, and I'm sure the NTSB and the FAA.
Yes, but what about the guy that's with him?
I mean, that's the concern.
You look through this, he had a flight instructor with him. The guy owned the company that's providing the instruction. He's all over the internet, so he has a lot of fame for his piloting skills and his flight instruction. A number of people who have had instruction from him were singing his praises. What happened? I mean, all of a sudden, did he go sideways? You know, but the first thing that came to my mind is, could we have had an exhaust leak in the airplane? It's been chilly up here in the Northeast. Could he have the heat on? Could we have an exhaust leak into the airplane? And, you know, given that it was a very short duration flight, it is possible that they got asphyxiated from exhaust.
Yeah. I mean, this was a late model 172, but again, I don't care if it's a brand new airplane, if it's not well maintained, or if you got a problem coming out of the factory that manifests itself, anything is possible. And that's going to be one aspect that the NTSB is going to have to look at, that of course, that's where the toxicology will be very important. It looks from the pictures that I've seen and some of the descriptions that this was at least a stall spin event, and it had to have happened at a low altitude, because recovery wasn't affected. And of course, they went into a wooded area, and both were fatalities. They did hit with a lot of energy. So whether the recovery was in process or there was no recovery because of the low altitude, again, those kinds of factors will have to be determined by the NTSB as to where they play out in the cause or contributing factors of this accident. Like you said, John, this is a short duration flight. They weren't in the air very long. They were basically going between airports that are, what, 20 minutes plus away from each other. I've flown out of Caldwell Airport when I was working for the NTSB up in New York, in the New York area, New Jersey area. I mean, it's a great airport. It's surrounded by woods and houses and that kind of stuff, but it's nothing extraordinary. But where this airplane supposedly crashed was over a wildlife area in the Delaware water, what they call the Delaware water gap. Now, I'm familiar with that area. I grew up on the East Coast in Maryland, flying all over that particular area, Maryland, Pennsylvania. I still fly in that area. I drive through there quite a bit because I hunt up in Pennsylvania. And so it is it's a picturesque place, especially this time of year because of fall colors. And, you know, were they maneuvering at low altitude, looking at stuff? Were they, you know, doing flight instruction? I know that You know, this pilot may have been trying to work on a commercial certificate. So who knows? Maybe they were doing some sort of training maneuvers that got out of hand. All of these are questions that we may or may not have answers to, either through the NTSB or just through the investigative process itself.
Yeah, you know, it's a shame with the way with the NTSB is operating today, is by the time we get, you know, they've increased, and you and I have had these conversations. It used to be the one-year mandate. And I can remember Ron Klieg and Bernie Loeb. If you didn't get it out in 1 year, they were all over you.
Yeah.
I mean, that they were senior management. Ron Klieg and Bernie Loeb were senior management at the NTSB. And they ran aviation accident investigation. And that 1 year, yeah, I mean, they'd be just shot of screaming at you.
Yeah. And again, you know, every accident deserves a thorough and methodical investigation process. You and I have been critical of the board, and we will continue to be critical of the board for not making that process happen. There are times where the board puts out stuff, even in a prelim, which is by their mandate supposed to be issued within a 10-day period of the accident. I know that we're bumping up on day 10 of the accident we're talking about today, and there is no prelim out. So I'm hoping that in the next day or two, we'll see something that may give us additional information that can help us talk about it and bring out those lessons learned and talk about what the board's going to be looking at. But until that happens, we really have nothing to go on other than the fact that we have two pilots, one highly experienced flight instructor, and a pilot who apparently has met the qualifications and been found at least qualified to hold an instrument certificate. They weren't in instrument meteorological conditions on the day of the accident. So now the question is, what were they doing? And if they were doing maneuvers, why were they doing them at such an altitude that did not afford them the protection of recovery? So, I mean, these are the kinds of things. But the thing that bothers me the most is we got a highly experienced flight instructor on board this airplane, and we've lost another set of pilots. For what reason? I mean, we've had now, I think, 15. I'm trying to track these flight instructor accidents. We've got 15 that I know of where we can verify that they were true flight instruction accidents that are all fatalities. Now, I know one of them that I'm currently working involves a mechanical malfunction of the airplane, which probably affected the ability of the pilots to recover. But the other ones are true training type accidents. And the question remains, what is going on? I mean, it's very, very frustrating. If you're a flight instructor, you're there as the safety tool. You're trying to teach. You're trying to instruct. You're trying to take a pilot, exercise at least your teaching abilities to train them how to do maneuvers. And yes, as an instructor, you have to expect that a student is not going to do it perfectly. They're going to be a little overwhelmed, especially if this is a new student pilot that is doing a maneuver. You have to be cocked and loaded and ready to intervene and recover the airplane if something goes awry. The question is, why aren't they doing that? Or why aren't they able to do that?
Yeah, so often, I'm still concerned about the time it takes for the NTSB to put out the information. Because right now we have in the aviation community a lot of focus on this accident. High profile person on a couple of levels. The astronaut that was killed, he has a following. And this flight instructor has a pretty large following himself in the aviation community. So you have the attention of a number of pilots. You could drive home a very capable learning moment if you have enough detail out there in a relatively short period of time so that people like us can work it into talking about and training people. But with the NTSB, with stretching out their time limits to 2 years, they're going to lose that communication moment.
Well, they've already lost it, John. You and I know, both know that, because that's why we have a show. I mean, you know, we're trying to get information out, some, you know, most of the time ahead of the NTSB. And even when the NTSB puts out a report, you and I start dissecting it and scrutinizing it. Some of their facts aren't really facts, and they aren't verified by the physical evidence or even supportable evidence that they claim that they're using as the basis for a probable cause. The other thing that really bothers me, especially in some of these larger accidents that, again, I'm working some of them, you and I are working one of them together, where they have indicted a manufacturer that puts an STC winglet on an airplane. They call that the problem, yet they produce no safety recommendations, no safety enhancements. And then on top of it, you got to wonder, well, they come out with a probable cause that you and I both don't think are supported by the facts. Where's the FAA? If this is the real cause and this is the real problem, where is the FAA? Good or bad, where is the FAA to either say, yeah, you're right, we got to do something about it, or no, you're wrong, you got to do something about it.
You know, what I find very troublesome with that particular accident is the fact that the NTSB's own performance report that they generate themselves internally without any real participation from anybody, any of the parties, it's all theirs. And the performance report is opposite what the NTSB has said happened further on in the report.
Yeah. Well, you and I are going to be using that accident. We're going to dissect that accident thoroughly so that we can let the listeners and our viewers see all of the evidence. I mean, there's been a lot written about this particular accident. We don't want to go into it right now because we got some issues that we have to work out. But the biggest concern here is that methodology continues throughout all these other accidents. And that is very frustrating because they swipe the pen, if you will. They come up with a probable cause that really is not based on all the facts, conditions, circumstances. You and I have used this term multiple times, called cherry picking, where they cherry pick a fact or a factoid to try and support a pet theory that really isn't supportable. And it's a disservice. And again, when you have these high profile accidents like this 172, you brought up a very good point. One, it's not that hard if you have competent investigators doing a competent investigation to be able to pull a bunch of information together in very short order to at least identify potential areas that are going to be addressed, and then see if we can't ferret out, learning lessons or lessons learned just from the prelim information. We know it's going to change because that's what investigation process basically results in, is the facts as they come out change the storyline. But there are moments that, you know, right now there's a big push to try and find out what could have happened to two people, a highly experienced flight instructor and at least a certificated private pilot with an instrument rating, flying a Cessna 172 that happened that so badly they lost the airplane that they couldn't recover it. There could also be a mechanical malfunction or failure that could be involved. And if that's true, then that's a safety critical element right now, because there are thousands and thousands of Cessna 172s operating out there, especially because flight training has increased so bad or so much that, again, if there is a safety issue, you better get the information out now. We don't have 2 years to wait.
Yeah, especially in mechanical failures. And, you know, my frustration at the board at the time was most of our mechanical problems that they just said it was a maintenance failure, and they let it hang like that. Can you imagine if we did that with the flight crews 30 years ago? Oh, the pilot made a mistake, and then just leave it right there.
Yeah.
We had no improvements. Well, that's the way we are in maintenance, because the NTSB doesn't get into the maintenance, into the nitty gritty in the maintenance arena like they do in the cockpit. And the consequence, we've had 60 years of NTSB almost reports that barely scratch the surface on maintenance involvement in accidents. I used to say they would take the accident to the hangar doors and right up to the hangar doors and say, oh, it's maintenance, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
And maintenance needed that help with, because if you don't identify the problems, then the FAA can't address them. And their resources are thin, and they're going to put their resources where they can identify the problems.
Yeah.
Maintenance needs the help today. I mean, we know that maintenance manuals aren't what they should be, especially on older general aviation airplanes. There needs to be improvements across the board in that area, and the NTSB is not helping facilitate those improvements.
Yeah, it is troubling. And again, you know, at the top of the show, we talked about all the accidents, all the fatal accidents that have happened just in the 2.5 weeks of the month of November. I mean, there are a lot of accidents, and of course, they involve a wide range of airplanes, from, like I said, a King Air through a Twin Comanche, Moonies, RVs, things like that. The concern I have is, are these accidents going to be just scraped up from the accident site, taken to a boneyard, and examined at a later date when all the evidence has degraded? Or is the thorough and methodical portion of that investigation with the volatile evidence happening right now, and it's just taking forever for the board to get that information out? Again, I mean, this is a safety organization that has a safety responsibility, but timing is the big thing, because pilots, mechanics, operators, and of course manufacturers need to know if there is some sort of safety issue that's causal or contributing to these accidents, get it back out so that we can learn from it, so we can enhance safety, either through a change of policy, procedure, SOPs, whatever, design, doesn't matter. But again, the timing has always been lousy. And waiting to, I got one accident. It's a simple accident involving a single engine airplane. We're 3.5 years into the investigation, and the board still has not put out a report. The other concern, John, of course, is, you know, not only the thoroughness of these investigations, but of course, getting those lessons learned. Are there things that can form the basis for the safety board to put out recommendations to improve safety? I haven't seen a lot come out of the NTSB in, better than 20 years of any substance that has really improved aviation safety. Now, I know they'll challenge that, but I'll be happy to take that challenge, because I haven't seen a lot of improvement. They've talked about loss of control. The FAA has talked about loss of control with their working groups. I haven't seen a lot of feedback come out of all of that effort to improve aviation safety, because guess what? We're still having a lot of loss of control accidents.
Yeah, that gets back to what I said in the beginning. We're doing the same things over and over and over again and expecting a different outcome. That's a definition of foolishness or something.
Yeah.
All right. We need to take a fresh look at what we know about training here in the 21st century. And yeah, I mean, so I see a lot of things online aimed at me because I teach school. And, I just got a whole bunch of material about how high school students think to help understand when they come into college. You need to understand how they were thinking in high school.
Yeah.
I mean, I think maybe we need to professionalize some of this training with educators that understand how we learn with a fresh look and a fresh set of eyes, because we're not reaching the pilots. We're not reaching the aviation community. We need to do something.
And you bring up a good point. I've raised this question a number of times. We all don't learn the same way. Some people are tactile learners. Some people can build these mental models and visualize things. Others can't. We don't do a very good job in training flight instructors on how to develop that particular teaching skill to those students, because you really got to, as a flight instructor, figure out from that student, I don't care if they're already a pilot or they're a brand new student pilot, what learning technique works best for that particular person. But then on top of that, flight instructors are the same way. Some are very visual, some are tactile. And of course, any kind of recurrent type training or new influence training that we're trying to bring into the flight instruction community, we have to take those kinds of learning techniques into account, and we have not done a very good job. The FAA put out a lot of information, but nobody reads it. And of course, nobody expresses it in a flight instructor refresher course and things like that. And all of these are the backstories. These are the underlying problems, why the message may not be getting through to those people that really need it the most. And then, of course, you always have the attitude, I already know that, I don't need it.
Yeah, we got a lot of that.
In
every segment. I mean, I hear mechanics. I've had more arguments over mechanics in general aviation airplanes. And, I don't need the manual. I've been working on this, on Cessnas for 20 years, 30 years. I don't need the manual. And I just, my hair in the back of my neck stands up and I cringe. Because boy, and that gets back to the manuals not being adequate in a lot of the old airplanes.
Exactly.
Don't you have something with Piper now with the manuals that are not accurate?
Yep, and a design issue. So we're going to be talking about that in the near future with our buddy Jason Lukasik. So, but John, looking at this 172 accident we've been talking about, you brought up the point that this flight instructor was well known. He's an internet hero, if you will. I mean, he's got a lot of information out there. He was lauded for putting an airplane down, Cessna, presumably a 172 that had an engine problem. He had a student on board. He was able to put it into the parking lot of a shopping mall successfully. So we know that his skills, abilities, and knowledge are well above average. And of course, the other pilot, DeFries, he apparently owned a single engine DA, probably a 40. It didn't really say, it just said he had a Diamond aircraft. But when you think about, okay, he's an owner. He understands ownership. He understands, of course, flying as a private pilot, because he's been flying for, I think 5 years, according to the information I've read. But, he even got a pilot proficiency certificate or badge from the FAA. That too is a demonstration. At least he's trying to do the right thing. He's keeping up with his flying. And in this case, he may have even been trying to keep up with Fisher, the flight instructor, to maintain a level of proficiency, but for the fact that whatever they were doing got themselves in trouble. The last thing I want to talk about is the fact that the internet blows up with information. A lot of people want to dissect these accidents using FlightAware data or FlightRadar 24. Those are good resources, but that data isn't necessarily always accurate. And of course, that's only a factoid. There has to be context to all of that information. So the stuff that I've read on the internet, that the airplane was at 5,000 feet MSL or 4,700 feet MSL. Okay, that's great, but that's about 1,000 above or 3,000 above, terrain in those particular areas. Again, so what? You have a ground speed. It's decayed, but you don't know why it's decaying. Is it because of an engine problem? Is it because of a mechanical problem? Is it because they're doing maneuvers? The internet people want to try and build storylines around those little factoids, and that's not fair from an investigative standpoint because it's not put in context. It's just factoids that somebody's tried to build a multiple of storylines around.
Yeah, it's terrible what they do with that data. They pollute that data with their opinions and sometimes it really casts aspersions on the family, it adds to the pain of the families.
Yep, exactly. I mean, we criticize and we're very, tuned into what the NTSB does and does not do. We do have to wait for them because by rule, they are the ones that go out there or they send the FAA out there to collect all the facts, conditions, and circumstances. And in our current roles, John, we are dependent somewhat on the board in determining whatever facts they're going to present to us. You and I dig a little deeper. We go behind the scenes and get more factual information that may not show up in a NTSB and or FAA storyline that we think is critical. But for right now, all we can talk about are those facts that are currently available, which there aren't many. But when you start learning about the backgrounds of these two pilots, you know, to just write it off that these two guys screwed up is just totally unfair, like you talked about, to the families until we have more facts, conditions, and circumstances to go on.
Yeah, these guys are too much experience to write it off for that. You know, they could have been doing maneuvers and then had an engine problem. Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows yet? I just hope that we don't lose, the NTSB doesn't leave any stone unturned in at least trying to get to the basics of the accident causation.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, as we talked about at the top of the show, our sponsor, Avemco, when you look at all the things that they do for the pilot and aviation community as far as insuring pilots, a variety of different pilot types of pilots, of course, the aircraft that they fly, you know, they too have to be tracking this, and they are somewhat dependent on the findings of the board to determine, again, trends and how they're going to underwrite particular risks, because that is their evaluation process, is determining the risk and seeing whether they want to take that risk. But it's not just them, it's every insurance company. And I just read an article recently that the older pilot community is up in arms with the insurance industry. They feel that they're being discriminated against. Those pilots that are in their 60s and 70s and even into their 80s, they believe that the insurance industry is discriminating against them because they're either charging them very high rates or they won't insure them at all. And that's taking the fun out of flying for these folks because they can't get insurance. And again, you and I are going to do some more research. We've talked about this, talking to not only our sponsor, but other folks in the insurance business that you and I both know, trying to get a handle on this. But you and I have also preached that if you are an older pilot, please talk to Avemco, because we have already talked to them about this particular subject. And they said, look, we'll evaluate. We'll talk to the pilot. Let's see what kind of experience they see, they have. Let's see what they're intending to do, what kind of aircraft they're intending to fly. You know, we don't have a problem with it. We just need to talk to them and get some good information before we decide we're going to sign on the dotted line to take that risk.
Yeah. And, you know, and they, for the other pilots in the greater community, I mean, they offer reductions in insurance. If just if you attend safety programs, you get 5% for listening to us. I mean, it's really, they bend over backwards to try to make the pilots that they insure the safest pilots that they can.
Yep.
And they try, but, you know, is it sticking? We get back to that same problem. With putting out all this information, we're packaging it up, we're giving it to them every which way we can, and the accident rate's still just going the wrong direction. What's missing? What are we not seeing?
Yeah, and really, one of the functions of the NTSB is to be doing what you and I are talking about. They need to be looking at trends. They need to be identifying it. It's one thing to just talk the talk, but if you're not going to walk the walk, then what good is talking the talk? They have all of this information. Now, as you and I have talked in the previous past, you know, statistics aren't very good if the information that you're basing those statistics on isn't very good. And that's my concern. And it's always been my concern, because they classify certain accidents or certain people in airplanes incorrectly. I don't know how many times they've incorrectly identified flight instructors as pilot rated passengers. That phonies the data. That doesn't demonstrate a flight instructor accident. So all of a sudden now you're pulling bad data. And now you really don't understand how many flight instruction related accidents there are and the causes and circumstances, because it hasn't been classified properly.
You know, and other people rely upon that data as well. I mean, AOPA puts out the NOL report.
Yeah.
And all the insurance industry uses a lot of the NTSB data. I mean, if it's skewed, it has far-ranging impacts.
Yeah.
And the the impact of the pandemic on the 2020 accident rate hasn't really been felt yet. You know, have you heard? I know we know that from people in the industry that have been collecting airplane crashes and storing the wreckage for the NTSB. Do we know at all that they've gone back and started to look at those airplanes?
They have, John. My concern is I was at a wreckage inspection recently where there were multiple wreckages laid out in the indoor facility where the wreckage that I was looking at was laid out as well. I happened to ask the question about those two other accidents with the wreckage laid out. And they said, oh yeah, the NTSB is coming in. The investigator's gonna look at both of those wreckages today. I said, there's no way. You cannot just rifle through a pile of wreckage and then move on to the next one and find anything of substantive value. That's not thorough and methodical. And to just go through the motions is a travesty because there is probably some safety added value by examining that wreckage to make sure that there is no evidence, no concrete evidence of a mechanical malfunction or failure. And again, you know, they scraped up all these wreckages, better than 400 of them, put them in storage, and now they got to catch up. So what kind of time are they going to spend? Not much.
That's a tragedy in itself.
Yeah. I mean, I know what it takes for me in my afterlife with the work that I do now. I mean, the people that I work with, you know, on both sides of the fence, because I do expert witness work and, you know, I'm doing plaintiff and defense work as many other colleagues that are in the same business. When we lay a wreckage out, we're looking at every single piece. And I know how much time that takes. And as an accident investigator, when I was with the board, it wasn't just a matter of going out there and kicking tin for an hour and saying it's good to go. So again, you know, the critical information and possibly even safety value information could be lost in just doing filling the square. And that is, yep, I looked at the wreckage, nothing was wrong. And now we're going to look at the pilot and we're going to write it off to, you know, pilot lost control for unknown reasons. That simply is not good enough for this industry to live with.
Yep, that's akin to what I've been saying. It's mechanical failure. Mechanic made a mistake in the hangar.
Yeah.
With no detail, no look behind that statement.
Well, I know that you and I will be following this 172 accident and many of the other accidents that have recently happened, you know, looking for those safety benefits. We had an accident out here, which we're going to talk about in a show in the near future, and that was involving a firefighting aircraft using new technology to fight a fire in a fixed-wing airplane, NVGs or non-night vision goggles. I had some concerns about it when I heard it was being done. I know it's been done in other venues, of course, in other situations, especially with helicopters. But now you're talking about trying to fly a single engine fixed wing airplane into very steep terrain, mountainous terrain at night, and then weather conditions. And of course, the contributory factor is, of course, the fire creating more turbulence in that immediate area. And a pilot trying to accomplish a mission using NVGs that, while they're great and they're a great tool, they do have limitations.
Yes. Yes. I mean, at nighttime, I think they're crazy.
Yeah. Well, and again, yeah, we can get into that discussion, but I know that what we're going to do is follow this accident, try and get some of the backstories that that may not come out. But again, we appreciate you, the listener and the viewer. We've got a lot of great emails. John and I are actually now talking about putting another show together where we talk about some of these emails because we've had some great contribution from our listener and viewer body. And so we want to acknowledge the good. We want to acknowledge the bad and everything in between because you've given us some great ideas and good feedback as to how we can make this show better and things that you want to listen to and hear us talk about. You can always contact us through our website or through our email account at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. So with that, my friend, We've put together another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. I will let you close us out.
Okay, and remind everybody, even though we have it on our opening and closing, that Avemco is a major sponsor of this show. We talked a lot about them during this show. They're good people to deal with. If you have a question about your insurance, give them a call. They'll talk to you about anything aviation. You tell them you listen to the show and you're going to get insurance. You get a 5% discount just for mentioning the show. I say it over and over again because I believe it. I've seen it. They're good people to deal with. And if you're going to go out and fly, remember the process starts before you even leave your house. You got to pre-planning, grab the weather, take a look at it. I mean, we've got a number of recent accidents involving weather that's occurring in between the departure city and the arrival city. The weather is all along the pathway. Don't take the risk of flying through storms. Go around it or stay home. And then if you do go to the airport, make sure you do a good session of pre-planning. Make sure you know where you're going to go and where you're going to land if something happens unexpected. Do a full and thorough pre-flight on your airplane. Learn how to do it. If you haven't done one or if you have any questions or concerns, get a mechanic that you've used before and have them go over the airplane with you. Give you the pointers that they use to see if the airplane is in good shape or not. And then if you fly, please fly safely. Don't be one of these statistics that we were rattling off earlier in this program. So please fly safe as you can.
To listen to more episodes of this show, go to flightsafetydetectives.com or your favorite place to listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening, and remember to fly safe.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.